From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. With the release of two American hostages in Lebanon, we all have questions about the kidnappers and their motivations for freeing the hostages. On this edition of Fresh Air, we discuss hostages and hostage takers with Charles Glass, an ABC News Middle East correspondent who was taken hostage himself in 1987 and escaped 62 days later. Also today, we meet the newest cast member of Saturday Night Live, Mike Myers. He's the creator of the sketches Wayne's World, Sprockets, and Middle-Aged Man. And book critic John Leonard reviews Absence. It's a new novel by Austrian author Peter Handke. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. White House officials held out little hope today that the recent freeing of two American hostages means that there will be any more releases of captives in the near future. Six Americans are still held by pro-Iranian terrorist groups in Lebanon. Presidential spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said today that the White House sees no reason for long-term optimism about future releases. Fitzwater said the latest signals from the Middle East suggest that the U.S. would have to offer concessions to get further help from Iran. The most recent former hostage, Frank Reed, enjoyed his first full day of freedom today in an American military hospital in West Germany. Deirdre Berger has more.
57-year-old Frank Reed was reunited with his wife and young son in Wiesbaden today. He's expected to spend several days at the U.S. Air Force Medical Center there for checkups and debriefing sessions. Doctors in Wiesbaden say Reed is tired and weak after his 43-month hostage ordeal, but otherwise well under the circumstances. After landing in a military jet at a U.S. Air Force base in Frankfurt, the thin but erect Reed walked alone to a waiting van. He flashed a double victory sign to the ground crew. His first request today was for a beer and a medium-rare steak. Reed met briefly with State Department officials this morning, but no official debriefing session on the conditions of his captivity is expected to be held for a day or so. For National Public Radio, this is Deirdre Berger in Wiesbaden.
The new style of May Day celebrations in the Soviet Union was marked today by demonstrations, disruptions, and outright cancellations in many of the country's largest cities. In Moscow, tens of thousands of reformers demonstrated against Kremlin policies in Red Square, jeering Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev and other Soviet leaders. Benjamin Rowe reports.
Shouts of shame, shame, and resign, resign echoed through Red Square today as the crowd of radical reformers demonstrated at the end of the Kremlin's official May Day celebration. Steps away from Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev and other members of the Politburo, the demonstrators also voiced support for Lithuania's independence drive and carried numerous banners denouncing the Soviet Communist Party. Gorbachev was also joined atop the Lenin Mausoleum by members of his new presidential council and the newly elected mayor of Moscow, populist Gavril Popov, who drew sustained cheers from the crowd. The marchers came into Red Square in five columns from around the city following the official May Day festivities marked by speeches and slogans from trade unionists. Soviet television, which carried the event live, abruptly cut its broadcast short when the demonstrators entered the square. There was no official celebration in Leningrad, and there were no red flags flying in the Lithuanian capital of Vilnius either. For National Public Radio, I'm Benjamin Rowe in Moscow.
Stock prices closed moderately higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 12 points to close at 2,668.9. This is NPR News. President Bush's aid request for Nicaragua and Panama was passed by the Senate today. There was $720 million in aid for the new Central American governments included in a $3.4 billion emergency spending bill the Senate approved after a week of delay. The action, on a voice vote, sent the spending package to a conference committee to work out differences with a $2.4 billion House version. The president has threatened to veto the measure if negotiators leave intact a Senate provision that would allow the District of Columbia to use local funds to pay for abortions for poor women. A strong earthquake rattled across south-central Alaska this morning and was felt by residents across a 500-mile area. Laura Wilkie with member station KBBI has more.
The earthquake struck just as people were settling into their workday at 8:12 in the morning. It measured 6.4 on the Richter scale and was centered 10 miles south of the town of King Salmon, located on the Alaska Peninsula at the head of the Aleutian Chain. The quake occurred some 220 kilometers beneath the Earth's surface. There were no reports of damage or injuries. Officials say that's because of the depth of the quake. That same fact is also credited with it being felt over such a vast distance. The event didn't generate a tsunami or tidal wave. Officials say strong earthquakes are common along the Alaska Peninsula and Aleutian Islands, but they're usually not felt over such a wide sweep of countryside. For National Public Radio, I'm Laura Wilkie in Homer, Alaska.
Defense Secretary Dick Cheney today extended a freeze on $7 billion in new military construction around the country. He also ordered a review of more than 200 congressionally approved projects that may be canceled. The Secretary's list of projects to be reviewed includes four of the Navy's six new strategic home ports, including one on Staten Island, New York, that's nearly finished. Cheney's announcement came as the House began debating the 1991 budget. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We promised you an interview today with South African journalist Alistair Sparks. We'll have that interview tomorrow. Today we're going to discuss the American hostages. Two Americans held hostage in Lebanon have been released in the last few days, Frank Reed and Robert Polhill. Analysts say it may be part of a new initiative by Syria and Iran to improve relations with the U.S. My guest Charles Glass has covered several hostage crises in his reports for ABC News. But for 2 months in 1987, he was a hostage himself. Glass was on leave from his job as ABC News Middle East correspondent. He was traveling through the Arab countries, working on a travel memoir. In spite of a U.S. order banning Americans from traveling in Lebanon, Glass was driving through a southern suburb of Beirut with his friend Ali Asaran, the son of Lebanon's Minister of Defense. They were kidnapped from the car by the militant Muslim fundamentalist group, the Hezbollah. Asaran was released after a week. After 62 days in captivity, Glass managed to escape by slipping out of his handcuffs and locking his captors in the apartment. Glass has just completed the book he was writing when he was taken hostage, and it includes the story of his capture and escape. It's called Tribes with Flags. Charles Glass is back with ABC, reporting on the Middle East. I asked him what he thinks is behind the current release of hostages.
I can only assume that hostages are being released now because some negotiations are going on. It's always been the pattern in the past that hostages have been released because of negotiations. This has been true for the Germans, for one South Korean who was released, for all the French hostages who have come out, and for the three Americans who came out in 85 and 86. Nobody gets out for free.
Negotiations between which parties?
The relevant actors in this whole drama are the United States and Iran. The others are just, I mean, the Hezbollah are simply acting as the surrogates of Iran and Lebanon. It's a way of allowing Iran to distance itself from the whole thing so that eventually they can have better relations with the United States if they want them.
So what do you think Iran is willing to negotiate behind the scenes with the U.S. now, if that's in fact what's happening?
Well, in 1985 and 1986, they were negotiating behind the scenes because they wanted American arms to be able to resist the Iraqi army, which was much more powerful, much better armed than their own. Now, there may be maybe other things that they want. They may want access to international loans, which the United States is now blocking. They may want an unfreezing of Iranian assets to the United States. We know they want that. They may well want the United States to take some action against Iraq, stop supplying Iraq with high technology, dual purpose goods that can be used for military purposes. And to stop loaning Iraq money or stop allowing the loans of large sums of money to Iraq because Iraq is Iran's enemy. I mean, the United States could easily do that because of Iraq's own human rights violations. It wouldn't be such a serious problem. The Iranians may also want some gesture that would allow them to allow their Hezbollah surrogates in Lebanon to claim some victory as well, which would mean the release of prisoners in Israel or the release of what they call hostages in Israel, Lebanese and Palestinians who were held in Israeli jails.
You know, it seems like the last kidnappings were of Americans who were the Americans most comfortable in the Arab world. You know, they chose to stay there. Even when the American State Department said, all Americans get out, these were the people like you who wanted to stay in Lebanon. And I'm wondering if you felt personally offended in a way. I know that's a silly way of putting it, but personally offended when you were kidnapped, because after all, you're part Lebanese. You were there because you have a special interest in that part of the world, and you were really doing your best at that time to understand all the different factions and all the different groups. within Lebanon and the rest of the Arab world.
It's worth bearing in mind that most of the people who are hostages in Lebanon are Lebanese. So for a foreigner to feel offended would be a bit misplaced. In fact, I suppose it's a proof that we've become Lebanized by just becoming hostages, because we've joined the Lebanese in one other form of their suffering. And the world, understandably, tends to ignore the plight of the Lebanese hostages because it is an internal Lebanese matter. The problem with the foreign hostage taking is that it is more to do with Iranian-American relations than with anything that's going on in Lebanon.
Well, so here you are being used, when you're taken hostage, as being used as a symbol of the United States, which you probably didn't see yourself as.
I don't see myself as a symbol of anything, but as an American journalist reporting on the area, as Terry Anderson didn't. Mm-hmm. Terry Anderson, very sympathetic to the people of the area, did more than any reporter to report on the suffering, particularly of the poor Shiites in Lebanon, the very people who, some of whom are holding him. But it didn't matter that these people were sympathetic. I mean, they were taking their own people hostages.
Charles Glass is my guest. He reports on the Middle East for ABC, and in 1987 he was kidnapped and escaped after 62 days. He was kidnapped by a Hezbollah group. He has a new book called Tribes with Flags that's about his travels through the Arab world. Would you describe the circumstances under which you were kidnapped?
Well, I'd gone down to South Lebanon for a few days with a friend of mine, a man named Ali Assayran, whose father was then the Minister of Defense in Lebanon, prominent, large landowning Shiite family. I was perfectly safe with the Assayrans in South Lebanon. But when we were driving back up towards Beirut through the southern suburbs, an area we had to go through, an area which was ostensibly protected by the Syrian army, I was surrounded by, or we were surrounded in our car by two other cars who stopped our car at gunpoint. And five men got out of the car in front of us. It was a green Mercedes. And from that point on, I was a prisoner.
Now, the people who kidnapped you were a subsidiary group of the Hezbollah, yes?
They were Hezbollah. I don't believe in the subsidiary group theory.
Well, what about this group that took Frank Reed, Islamic Dawn?
I believe, this is a name they made up really 2 days ago. They seem to make up names for occasions. I don't believe that there's more than one organization. Now, I could be wrong, but I don't see how there could be. I mean, there's been one organization all along involved in the kidnapping. And it's interesting that the release of Paul Hill seems to have come from a group calling itself Islamic Jihad for the Liberation of Palestine, and the release of Reed from another group calling itself something else, two different groups within 8 days. If they are indeed two different groups, it seems rather odd. I think that there's one group using different names, both responding to Iranian orders.
What do you think the point is of making it seem like there's lots of different groups?
It's part of a general campaign of disinformation by both Iran and the kidnappers to keep everyone guessing. They don't want to be found out. They don't want it to be known who they are. They want to be able to distance themselves from it, partly because they don't want to be arrested when one or the other of them might be flying around Europe, partly because they may one day want to mend their fences with the United States and pretend they had nothing to do with it.
For people who haven't been following the Middle East very carefully, give us a very brief crash course on what the Hezbollah is, what you think their ultimate goals are.
Hezbollah is a group that didn't exist before the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in 1982. In that invasion, South Lebanon was pretty badly hit. And a lot of people, because the majority of people who live in South Lebanon are Shiite peasants, the poorest people in Lebanon. Their villages were badly damaged. The young men were arrested and placed in concentration camps in South Lebanon. And this community, which had not been hostile to Israel before, indeed which had had very bad relations with the Palestinian commandos in South Lebanon, suddenly was enraged by Israeli policy in Lebanon. Now you put that together, that rage, together with something else that happened at the same time, which was the arrival of Iranian Revolutionary Guards in Lebanon, supposedly sent by Iran to help in the defense of Lebanon, but in fact which never fought the Israelis directly, set up its headquarters in Baalbek in eastern Lebanon in the Bekaa Valley, and from there began missionary activities to create a new Shiite Muslim movement in opposition to an old Shiite Muslim movement which was more moderate called Amal, headed by a man named Nabi Bari. Hezbollah, unlike all the other parties in Lebanon, was completely underground, maintained no public offices, had no press officer, nothing. It just had secret attacks, suicide attacks on the Israelis, and later suicide attacks on the Americans, always claiming it under different names, but the posters on the walls that began appearing always said Hezbollah, which means party of God. And in the Arabic understanding of Hezbollah, party of God, it means on the side of God. So that those who are on the side of God are on the side of justice and right, and everyone else is on the other side, the side of evil. So they began, their people, their followers, saw us, those who represented America for them, as somehow evil.
When you were kidnapped by Hezbollah, did you have any contacts as a journalist inside the group, contacts that you thought might ultimately be of use to you in getting out?
I had interviewed many of their leaders and some of their followers over the years in Lebanon and knew some of them pretty well. But contacts of that kind wouldn't have done any good.
Right. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about how you were kidnapped, what the experience was like, how you escaped. My guest is Charles Glass. He's a Middle East correspondent for ABC News. In 1987, he was on a leave of absence from ABC, traveling through the Middle East, researching a book. He was kidnapped in Beirut and escaped after 62 days in captivity. His new book, Tribes with Flags, is the one that he was researching while he was taken hostage. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Charles Glass is my guest. When you were being held hostage, what did they want from you? Was there an ultimate goal that they wanted from you, a confession, information?
Really, what they wanted was for me to keep quiet so that Iran would someday use me for some purpose. Occasionally.
They mean barter, trading you for something else?
Well, as they traded arms for hostages
right.
Before. Really, it was a holding operation.
Mm-hmm.
Once I was forced to make a confession on videotape, stating that I worked for the CIA, which wasn't true, but I was told I'd be killed if I didn't read it. The reason for that, I discovered after I escaped, was that the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Vernon Walters, was on his way to Syria to ask for Syrian help again in the release of hostages, all the hostages, including me, and that the Hezbollah got slightly nervous that the Syrians might step up their activities as a result of that. So they tried to discredit me and therefore discredit any Syrian help for me as though the Syrians were being used by the CIA. And so I was told later that the Syrians dropped their more serious efforts to try to find me and that, in fact, the videotape worked. Apart from that, during the few interrogations, as I recall, I had 4 or 5 interrogations during 62 days, they were trying to see if I knew anything about the presence of other Americans in West Beirut, which I didn't. I didn't believe there were any others. About anything I might know about an American rescue attempt for the hostages. Again, I knew nothing about it. My own background and things like that in general. But again, having listened to Frank Reed when he came out, he said pretty much the same thing. They just held me. They never tried to propagandize me. They never tried to persuade me that they were right and that I was wrong. There was nothing like that. They weren't really interested in what I thought. I was just being kept there, barely kept alive, given the basic minimum to keep alive. In fact, sometimes less. Sometimes I was so dehydrated I thought I was going to be terribly, terribly sick. But in general, just kept alive so that one day I too could be delivered.
You were asked to read and be filmed while you were reading a statement saying that you were really with the CIA. And you came up with a lot of clever ways to show whoever saw this film that you were forced to make it. You crossed your fingers, the fingers that were holding the paper. You tried to speak with a Southern accent because, for one, people would know that's not the way you talked, and also you hoped that it would be a clue that you were being held in the southern part.
The southern suburbs of Beirut, yes.
Yeah. Nevertheless, when there was this film circulating, saying that with you saying that you were really an operative for the CIA, did anyone believe it? Anyone in the States? Did you ever feel like when you got back here that there were people who really wondered, well, maybe he really was with the CIA?
No one's ever said that to me from the States or from Western Europe. I did have a Lebanese journalist who came to interview me shortly after I got out, a very nice young man. And he said, "Are you a CIA agent?" And I said, "No." And he said, "But you said you were." And I said, "Well, I was forced to say that. They said they would kill me." And he said, "But you said it." And I said, "Well, you know, when people come to you and say they'll kill you if you don't say certain words, and you don't particularly want to die that day, you will say it." And he said, "Yes, but you said it." There's no getting over that. I mean, I'll never persuade him that something said under duress isn't really something that's true. But apart from that, no, I don't think anyone's believed it.
Could you describe briefly how you managed to escape?
I was very lucky to be able to escape, and it came about as a stroke of ill luck, or what I thought at the time was a stroke of ill luck, in the place where I was being held for some time, which was sealed up like a prison, an apartment sealed up with steel sheets over the windows like a prison. I had been putting notes out the ventilating system of the building, where there was a fan in the bathroom, and when I was occasionally allowed to go to the bathroom, I put these notes out in English, French, and Arabic, asking whoever found them to find my friends. Unfortunately for me, or I thought at the time, unfortunately, the only person who found one of those notes was one of my guards. And when the guard found it and showed it to the other guards and their superiors were called in, they became frantic. And so they had to move me very quickly to a place that wasn't prepared, to just an ordinary apartment, which wasn't sealed. And I knew that if I could get out of my chains in the new room that I was placed in, there was nothing to stop me getting out of the apartment. And I managed through, I don't know, looking at it as almost as a problem of mathematical logic, to figure out a way to get out of the chains over a period of 17 days, working on them day by day by day, until finally one day I was ready to slip them off. And when my guards went to sleep, as they did every night, I was able to slip them off and get out of the apartment.
Hadn't they sealed it off and prepared the house by the 17th day?
Well, I was in it. I think it was a temporary holding place until they could prepare another place.
After you escaped, you managed to get a ride to a hotel where you knew people knew you. And when you got to the hotel, there were some people from the Syrian military there, and you asked for their help and protection. They called their people.
Well, no, that's not what happened. No, okay. What happened was, when I got to the hotel, there were Syrian soldiers milling around out front, as they often do, and I walked up to them and I asked for their help, and they just looked at me and they said, "Majnoon," which means crazy. They just thought I was crazy. So I said, "All right, well, I'll forget about you guys," and I went into the hotel and saw the receptionist in the dorm, people I knew, because I'd used to swim at the beach at that hotel a lot, and I'd stayed there before. And they quickly took me back into the office, and we tried to figure out what to do. I called a couple of friends of mine, one a doctor who lived nearby, and the other was a man named Qasem Derham, who used to be my driver with ABC in Beirut, and a very dear friend. And they came rushing over, and we were trying to figure out how best to get me out of there without getting me kidnapped again. And the security guard of the hotel got very cold feet and decided the only thing he could do would be to tell the Syrian army, who happened to be having a party in the bar downstairs, and one of whose officers came up a bit drunk and took me off to Syrian military headquarters.
When the Syrian military found out that you had escaped, they wanted to fly you to Damascus before...
Well, I wanted to fly home directly. Beirut Airport was open at the time.
Yeah.
I wanted to fly home directly to London and see my family. And they told me, "We'd love to allow you to do that. There is a flight in the morning. But we can't. We have checked with Damascus. We have orders from Damascus. We must have the honor of presenting you in Damascus." They then delayed my trip to Damascus, made me stop in the Bekaa Valley for a few hours so that everyone would be up in time and so the international press would have time to arrive so that Syria could then claim credit.
So you think this is about publicity for Syria and about claiming credit for your release?
The whole thing has been about publicity for Syria, to present Syria in a better light, including the...
What whole thing?
The whole process of bringing people to Damascus, which is entirely unnecessary, stretching out their time before they can get home.
Frank Reed was brought to Damascus.
Frank Reed was brought to Damascus. Robert Polhill was brought to Damascus. Professor Singh was brought to Damascus. They're all brought to Damascus unnecessarily. Syria can claim credit. There's a press conference in Damascus. Everyone's on televisions, often live, and the Syrians can claim credit.
Syria had a Syrian reporter with Frank Reed in the car as he drove to.
No, the Syrian television had a reporter in the car with Robert Polhill. With Frank Reed, they interviewed him in a room. somewhere. Okay. And again, that was a Syrian. They had first access to him, and then they tried to sell that footage, the Pole Hill footage, to the networks, but the networks refused to pay, so they simply gave it to them. They wanted it on American television anyway.
When you escaped, there was speculation back in the United States that, well, you thought you'd escaped, but really it was kind of engineered by the Syrians, and they had made a deal with Iran and the Hezbollah, and it was agreed that they would let you escape. Did you believe that at all? And what was your reaction when you got out to the people who were saying that they let you escape?
Well, first of all, I have no interest in lying about it one way or the other. I mean, if I was very happy to be free.
Yeah.
If I'd been let out, if I'd been rescued, if I escaped, I didn't care how I got out. I just wanted to get out. As far as I could tell, I arranged my own escape. And I think if anyone reads the last chapter of the book and sees the process that I went through to get out, and the luck that was involved, there's a lot of luck involved, that I'm not claiming any great heroism for myself. I'm not trying to make it a better story. It just happens to happen that way. On the other hand, the Syrian media, who were the ones who were making the claim, their track record for honesty isn't quite as good as that of the average American journalist. And I mean, if you want to believe the Syrian media, believe them, please. I mean, there's nothing I can do about that. I'm sorry, but the fact is, as far as I can tell, I got myself out. I don't mind if people don't want to believe that.
Do you think that when the Syrians' drive released hostages to Damascus for a press conference first, that they're taking undue credit for the release of hostages?
Well, see, Syria's only role is it happens to be the de facto military power on the ground in Beirut. And so it's very difficult to maneuver without them. In other words, they could block it if they wanted to. They could make it very difficult. But what's happening is Hezbollah is handing these people over to the Syrian military in Beirut in broad daylight. The Syrian military knows who these people are handing them over. If they wanted to do more to squeeze them, they could.
Your mother was Lebanese.
Well, my mother's American, born in Lebanon. My grandmother came from Lebanon when she was a very young girl. But there still is a kind of tie there.
And that's part of the reason why you've been so absorbed in that part of the world for so many years. Do you feel now that you have a love-hate relationship with Lebanon? Lebanon love because it's where part of your family's from, because you're fascinated with that part of the world, but also hatred and fear because it was in that part of the world that you were.
Well, no,
hostage.
I don't have any bitterness because of what happened to me, not towards the Lebanese or anyone really. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have some bitterness against the specific organization and its benefactors that took me, but not because they took me, but because they killed two of their hostages. They killed William Buckley, the CIA chief. I don't care if he's working at the CIA or not. I think murder is wrong. And they killed Colonel William Higgins last August, and I think that was wrong. And I have a lot of bitterness against them for that. That was very, very bad. I'm out. I'm fine. I don't feel anything against them for that. I like Lebanon. I like Israel. I like Jordan. I like Syria. I like that whole region. And I wish someone would force peace down their throats.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Charles Glass's book about his travels in the Arab world and his kidnapping by the Hezbollah is titled Tribes with Flags. Glass reports on the Middle East for ABC News. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, as the African National Congress and the South African government hold talks for the first time, we'll be joined by South African journalist Alistair Sparks. He's the Johannesburg correspondent for The Washington Post. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Live from New York, it's Saturday night!
Coming up, we meet America's newest superhero, middle-aged man. He's just one of Mike Myers' creations. Myers is the newest cast member of Saturday Night Live. He also originated the sketches Wayne's World and Sprockets. Is Myers loud and stupid like Wayne, or tedious and pretentious like Dieter? Stay tuned. Also, book critic John Leonard has found a novel even he doesn't understand. It's by Austrian writer Peter Handke. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Doreen McAllister. After a week of delays, the Senate has passed a $3.4 million emergency spending bill that includes $720 million in aid for Nicaragua and Panama. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The spending package now goes to a conference committee to be reconciled with the House-passed version of the aid bill. President Bush has threatened to veto the Senate version of the bill because it includes a provision that would allow the District of Columbia to use its own local funds to pay for abortions for poor women. The House bill contains no such provision. The spending bill represents the first application of the so-called peace dividend because the money used for the new foreign aid for Panama and Nicaragua is taken from military programs. Today, the president of Panama was on Capitol Hill. He said his country would use the $420 billion in aid from the bill to repair damage done by the U.S. invasion of his country, the invasion that toppled dictator Manuel Noriega and put him in power. But Endara said Panama would not ask for more U.S. aid next year. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
The House has adopted the Democrats' $1.2 trillion federal budget plan for next year. The plan makes deep cuts in President Bush's defense plans and channels much of the savings into social programs. The plan provides more than $295 billion for next year's military programs. That's about $8 billion less than what President Bush has proposed. Israeli officials deny the U.S. is pressuring them to release a kidnapped Muslim cleric. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Yesterday's release of a second American hostage, Frank Reed, puts the hostage ball squarely in the American court. Israel has one thing that both Iran and the Iranian-backed Hezbollah, which is believed to be holding the Western hostages, want. Israel kidnapped Sheikh Abdullah Karim Obeid, a Hezbollah cleric, last summer and hoped to use him in a hostage trade. Today, Israeli officials denied American press reports that the Bush administration is pressuring Israel to release Obeid. Senior Israeli officials say it is unthinkable that Israel will release him unless the deal includes three Israeli soldiers believed to be held by Hezbollah. Hezbollah refuses to discuss the Israelis. Iran has said no more American hostages will be released until the United States makes a goodwill gesture to Iran. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Freed American hostage Frank Reed celebrated his first full day of freedom with a beer, a large steak, and a long-awaited reunion with his wife and son. A special State Department team has begun questioning the 57-year-old educator at the U.S. Air Force Hospital in Wiesbaden, West Germany. They're hoping for clues about the 16 remaining Western hostages in Lebanon. Six Americans are still being held. Prices were higher on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average climbed more than 12 points to close at 2668.92. Advances led declines 8-7 in moderate trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Mike Myers may be the best thing that's happened to Saturday Night Live in the past year. He's the newest and youngest cast member on the show. He's the creator of the sketch Wayne's World, a cable access TV show hosted by a loud, obnoxious teenager played by Myers. Myers also developed the character Dieter, the pretentious host of Sprockets, a postmodern culture show on West German TV. Myers just debuted a new character, middle-aged man, a paunchy superhero who dispenses advice to younger people like this couple in bed.
This has never happened to me, I swear.
It's all right. It's all right.
I just lost it.
Well, was it me? Did I do it wrong?
No. I don't know what happened.
Maybe I can help.
Who are you?
I'm middle-aged man. Now, what's the trouble?
Well, see, he just had a problem with the, you know...
Will you shut up?
What was it? Too soon or not at all? Ha ha! Just a quip. It could be stress or cheap liquor. Tell me, have you injured yourself by doing any heavy lifting?
Well, I was putting up some aluminum siding.
Aha! You realize that reduces the value of your home.
Really? Are you sure?
Of course I'm sure. I'm a middle-aged man.
You started a new character on the last Saturday Night Live, middle-aged man. Who were you thinking of?
I was thinking of myself, as I always do. That sounds awful. No, I was just, I was doing, there was a scene the week previous called The Award Show Award Show, which didn't make it to air, and I had to play Sir Richard Attenborough. So the hair and glasses is for Sir Richard and the teeth, too, is for Sir Richard Attenborough. And last week, on a Friday before the show, I just happened to be changing out of my costume, and I've noticed that since I've gotten on the show, as with everybody who's been on the show, I put on 15 pounds, and I have what we call in Canada a Molson muscle. I'm starting to get a gut. So it was like, oh, no, I'm looking at my gut. And then I just thought of, this is what I'm going to look like when I'm middle-aged. I mean, it's not going to be that terrible. I'm going to know how escrow works. And then that amused me, and I thought, well, that could be a superpower. And then it just went from there.
So how long did this sit in your mind before you actually pitched it to the people at Saturday Night Live? Not very long, I guess.
No, in fact, it was the first time ever that I ran upstairs to the conference room in the whole complex where all the writers hang out and started doing this character, sort of like, I'm a middle-aged man. I know how escrow works. Yeah, sure, I'm not as spry as I used to be, but I can tell you how to paint a garage. What are you looking at? You're looking at my gut, aren't you? I'm working on it. I'm just older. It's harder to lose a gut. Forget it. Middle-aged man. That sort of stuff.
So is there anyone in your life who's like middle-aged man, who's always coming up with this not particularly wanted advice, with this self-righteous Mr. Know-it-all attitude?
Yeah, it was a friend of mine, who will go unnamed because I don't want to hurt his feelings, and my dad. He sold encyclopedias, so his knowledge was encyclopedic. So you'd say something like Rembrandt, and he'd go, Lord of Light. Lord of Light, he is. And just it was like out of nowhere, and just weird, inappropriate advice is what he would give you.
So what kind of prosthetics did you have to wear for middle-aged man?
Oh, they had a prosthetic gut. That's not my gut in life. They had like a gut made for me. And I had to wear a ball cap and a receding hairline wig and a gap between my teeth and a pair of glasses. And away you go. And a comedy. And hilarity ensues, hopefully.
So is the character going to recur?
I hope so. They kept the costume, which is always a good sign.
Let's get to Wayne's World. This is one of your most popular characters. Wayne hosts an access cable TV show in Aurora, Illinois. He's a teenager who's really into heavy metal. Describe the character some more.
Well, Wayne is a compilation or a distillation of everybody I knew growing up in the suburbs of Toronto. It's a sort of adolescent, suburban, heavy metal experience. And so I thought, what if my character Wayne, who I did at Second City in Toronto and Second City in Chicago, had his own cable access show? Hopefully it would be how I was when I was a kid, which is, God, it would be great to have my own show in my basement. And then I'd have anybody I wanted on to be on. And it's completely, it makes no attempts to be universal. It's just totally about his basement and his world.
All right, welcome to Wayne's World. Here's your host, Wayne Campbell.
Party! Woo! Party harder!
Woo!
It's Friday, it's 10:30, it's time to party. I'm your excellent host, Wayne Campbell. With me, as always, is Garth.
Party on, Wayne.
Party on, Garth. Okay, before we bring out our first guest, we'd like to introduce our newest feature. It's called Movie World with Wayne and Garth.
Movie World! Movie World! With Wayne and Garth! Let's
Woo! All right, let's take a look at the movies, all right? The first movie is Back to the Future 2, starring Michael J. Fox. I liked it, Garth.
Yeah, I liked it too.
Okay, let's move on.
Did you ever talk in the kind of teen slang that Wayne is always coming up with?
Yeah, I did. I went through a lot of adolescent phases. I went through a heavy metal phase, and then I went to England in 1977 just as punk was big. I went through a punk phase. Then I saw the movie Quadrophenia. Did you ever see that with The Who?
Yeah, yep.
And I went through a mod phase. There's a ton of mods in Toronto. It would be like, you know, it'd be mod bars. People would actually go out and buy Vespas and stuff. And then I got hired at Second City. By that time, I just turned 19, so I was out of my adolescent thing. Although when I got hired at Second City, I had really short hair and a long tail down my back.
So do you keep your ears open for teenagers to hear what kind of language is? Because language changes so quickly.
Yeah, it does. But I'm surprised that it doesn't change all that much.
Mm-hmm.
There seems to be an adolescent accent, which is weird, that people tend to grow out of or socialized out of. And I was surprised at how homogenous to North America it is.
Did you have it?
Yeah, it was be like, yeah, I don't know what you mean. Hey, back off. Don't hassle me, man. It'd be like that. I really like that guy, you know? And it's strange, too, because people who are in the arts had the same type of accent in Toronto, too. It's just, I really like that painting. I really thought it was great. I like his use of negative space. You want a cappuccino? I really like it there.
This is the roots of Dieter, right?
Yes. Well, that's the thing. They're all related. It's all...
See,
what tribe? It's tribes. You know,
we just found, I couldn't believe that there'd be any kind of link between Wayne and Dieter, but I guess you just...
Well, it was a friend of mine in Toronto who never actually got to be an artist, but did everything around art. Like, he was interested in photography, but he ended up painting backgrounds, you know, like the splotches of paint. And he was interested in being a filmmaker, but he got into colorizing and somehow managed to justify colorizing, even though it's sort of impolitic in the art world.
For our listeners who haven't seen Sprockets, which features your character, Dieter, would you describe it for us?
Dieter was a young artist from Stuttgart who came to Toronto. He's an actual person.
Oh, no, really?
Yeah, and he was a waiter in Toronto, and he would, like, take your order and say, what would you like? And then you would start to talk, and if it was a hot dog or something banal, he would say, your order has become tiresome. I'm going away now. And if his favorite tune came on, it would be like, yes, and would you like, hold on, my favorite song. And he would go up and dance. And then you'd wait for hours. But he was fascinated with obscure Americana, like F Troop and hockey cards. He loved hockey. That was our main thing that I thought I could talk to this person. Was he loved hockey, and I thought it was amazing. And he also loved to touch monkeys.
Oh.
And that's actually true, because he took a textures course in Stuttgart. And he had to touch tapioca, styrofoam, and monkeys. And it was that time that I knew that I loved to touch monkeys.
See, for our listeners who haven't seen Sprockets, there's always a sequence in Sprockets where he says,
Would you like to touch my monkey?
Yeah, I could never figure out where that was from.
It's just because he took a textures course. And, you know, I love textures. Your eyebrows are bizarre. Can I touch them? You know, he'd say things like that.
Yeah, you have such a great way in that show of intellectualizing everything that's fun or pop or...
With Dieter.
With Dieter, yeah.
Any sort of pretentious or pseudo-pretentious idea I ever had, I can sort of stick it into Dieter, and Dieter can do it. And it's like, it's not me, it's this guy.
That was Vietnam by Schreibmaschine. And now's the time for Rater Record. What is your name?
My name is Gerhard Müller.
My name is Elsa Bauer.
And what gymnasia do you go to?
We go to the Goethe-Gymnasium in Garmisch-Partenkirchen.
Your hair is grotesque. What did you think of the song on a scale of 1 to 14?
It was hellish yet exquisite. I give it a 9 out of 14.
I thought it was bourgeois and banal. I give it a negative 3 out of 14, and I thought lyrically it had...
Your story has become tiresome. Sadly, there are no integers on this scale. So your gangly adolescent attempt to be clever has been futile.
Well then, Dieter, what did you think of the song?
It had a good beat and it was easy to dance to. I gave it a 14. This next song is called Darwin's Burden by the Obelisks.
So this waiter, Dieter, mm-hmm. upon whom you model the character, does he know that this is an homage to him?
I don't think he does. And somebody told me he went back to... Germany for a bit. His visa had expired. And then somebody told me he moved to Australia, which makes total sense. So I'm sure it'll get back to him, but he's far too cool to ever call me and say, I understand you are doing me. You know, it would be just too not cool.
My guest is Mike Myers of Saturday Night Live. We're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Mike Myers is my guest from Saturday Night Live. How did you get on Saturday Night Live?
I worked at Second City in Toronto, and they had a 15th anniversary. And Pam Thomas, who is Dave Thomas's wife, who also used to cast on SCTV, Dave Thomas was on SCTV, called up Lorne Michaels and said, you've got to see this kid and whatever and all that stuff. And Martin Short was at the 15th anniversary and said, oh, I'll call as well if you like. And I said, sure, if you want. And so they called up, and it was really nice of him. And both of them called up Lorne Michaels, the producer of the show. And I went and had a meeting, and they looked at tape of stuff I did in Canadian TV, and then they hired me.
Mm-hmm. So my understanding is that you got signed by SCTV on high school graduation day?
No, well, not SCTV, Second City Theater Company.
Right, okay, in Toronto. Toronto.
Yeah, my was my last day of high school. My exam was at 9 o'clock. My audition for Second City was at 12 o'clock, and I was hired at 3 o'clock.
How did they know you? What did you do to get hired that young?
I'd done the workshop program when I was 18. I'd just turned 19, like 2 weeks before. And I did two sessions of it where I had to pay, and then I didn't have any money. And they said, well, just stick around. And so I did. And I auditioned actually once when I was 18, and then 3 weeks later again when I was 19, and then they hired me.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of characters did you do on Second City? Did you do character sketches?
Yeah. Toronto Second City is much more character-oriented than Chicago Second City. Chicago Second City tends to be more of the political theater, political satire mode. And Toronto is as well, only we don't have nearly the vibrant political scene that there is down here. So it tends to be more character-oriented, which is why SCTV got the show and was character-based. Because, you know, we don't have a debate about gun control. We have it. We don't have a debate about socialized medicine. We have it. We don't send foreign armies anywhere. We don't have an army to send like that. So the politics aren't as strong, you know, and as day-to-day. So we're more character-based.
So you developed Wayne's World for Second City.
Well, I did Wayne as a character. I did it in a sort of a mock Shakespearean Romeo and Juliet thing.
Oh.
Where, so I am to be banished, for I am from the Campbell clan. And then it just went on half Shakespeare and half not. And but the character I did on Canadian TV, I used to do a thing called Wayne's Power Minute on a show called It's Only Rock and Roll, where I would just do a minute on any topic that inspired me that day.
Did you go to college after getting signed to Second City right after high school?
No, I didn't. I was that day, strangely enough, that I got hired. Last day of high school, hired Second City. I go home, check the mail at 4 o'clock, and I was accepted to York University that day to study film. So it was like, here's all your options for the rest of your life. Now! So my plan was if I didn't like Second City, I would use that money towards university. And I ended up really liking it, so I didn't go to university.
What were your plans if you studied film? Did you want to be a film critic or a
director? I wanted to be
Francois
Truffaut.
Uh-huh.
And Martin Scorsese and Fellini and more of the Dieter side of me. Oh, also, too, I would like to have made films like Breaking Away and Strange Love. But I think ultimately my hero is Peter Sellers, and I think I would have been frustrated. It would have been a means of being able to perform in comedy.
You didn't have imaginary films that you shot in your bedroom or anything
like that,
did you?
I made Super 8 films.
You did?
I did, yes, indeed.
What kinds of films?
Oh, real embarrassing stuff.
Hey, great, tell.
Yeah. I did a film about this guy who's a tortured punk because he had to live in the suburbs and be a punk rocker. And it was called Punk in Transit. It was so bad. I don't know why I'm telling you this. So it was very embarrassing.
You did commercials as a kid?
Yeah.
What kinds of commercials?
I used to actually have my resume memorized. It was like Kit Kat, Applejack, Sunlight, BC Hydro, Datsun, and Kmart shoes, Wrigley Spearmint gum. Just anything where they needed a little red-headed kid. You know, gee, Mom, this is the best. That was me. And then I went through my punk phase, and I couldn't get cast for my life because I had really short hair and T-shirts that said Anarchy in the UK. And they wanted, like, a little kid who plays basketball. And I'd be like, yeah, forget it. Basketball's bourgeois. So I never I stopped doing that.
So how old were you when you stopped?
My last commercial, I was 17, and I haven't done one since.
Well, that's pretty old, actually.
Yeah.
I just expected you were doing it for baby food or something when you were really young.
No, I started when I was 8, and I did a dancing commercial.
Oh, great,
for
with Datsun. Tap shoes and everything?
No, it was jazz dancing, which is even more a secret. Sort of dancing, solid gold type dancing that nobody really should see. And that's what I was doing.
Thus the corniest kind of dancing, the kind of interpretive dancing
no,
on
cornier.
Commercials. Yeah.
No, there's cornier dancing, and that's the reason I got into dancing was there's a show on Canadian TV called The Pig and Whistle, which was a mock pub show, British pub show for British expatriates who were like really homesick, and it was like, come in to the Pig and Whistle, come in and have a laugh. And then they'd had these Cockney, like, Mary Poppins dancers, you know, with the kerchiefs tied around their neck and flat caps and a lot of posing and a lot of knee slapping. Knees up, Mother Brown, knees up, Mother Brown. And I thought, now I was 4, and I thought that was the coolest thing ever, to dance like the guys in Mary Poppins. And so I said, can I do that? And my mom said, sure. So I went to the dance people, like the choreographers of that show, and they also had a dance school. And that's where I got into commercials.
You've come a long way, haven't
well,
you?
Well, I've come a long way since The Pig and Whistle.
So that's how you started doing commercials?
Yeah.
The name of the psychotic killer who escapes from the institution in Halloween is Michael Myers.
Yes.
Did you hear about this a lot when when the
movie
came out?
Yeah, whenever I go to cash a check, it's Michael Myers, the killer. Just don't kill me. Honestly, I'll cash the check. And I have to give them one of those, that's funny, I never get that, laughs. That's great, I never get that, that's great. And, no, we're completely different. He's the evil Michael Myers, I'm the good Michael Myers. I mean, while it's true, I do own a mask made out of flesh. I wear it infrequently. And I've really never killed anyone, to my knowledge. So I think that's where the similarities end.
Mike Myers, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Mike Myers is a cast member of Saturday Night Live. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, do you have any further analysis on the release of Frank Reed?
On Frank Reed's release and on whether or not the people in the Middle East think there will be more hostages coming out in the near future. We're also going to look at the May Day celebrations in Red Square in Moscow. Apparently, this was a May Day like no other. After the traditional parade of labor unions, there was a very untraditional parade, an anti-Gorbachev untraditional parade. And, Terry, we're also looking at some little-known birds. These are birds that you may not know too much about, the mangrove penguin, the fixed-wing falcon. You know about these?
They're news to me. Well, I'll find out about them. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The plays and novels of Austrian writer Peter Handke are sometimes hard to decipher. They don't always stick to conventional forms. Handke's novels include The Goalie's Anxiety at the Penalty Kick, Short Letter, Long Farewell, and Afternoon of a Writer. Book critic John Leonard has a review of Handke's new novel, Absence.
Having only just recovered my enthusiasm for the difficult fiction of Peter Handke, I'm amazed to see that he's already got another novel out. Last year's Afternoon of a Writer seemed to me to affirm the artist's vocation about as well as it can be done, and I'm quoted saying so on the jacket of the new book. But the new book, Absence, is a different beast entirely. It's a fable, a parable of identities lost and paradise regained. In a nameless city, in an unnamed country, 4 strangers gather for a train trip to the Twilight Zone. An old man who's always scribbling in his notebook, a young woman always looking into her mirror, a soldier whose own mother wouldn't recognize him on the street, and a gambler who'd rather be an artist, flee some catastrophe, an earthquake maybe, or Chernobyl. They leave castles, statues, walls, squares, a monotone humming, and the very symbolic Hotel Europa, for a symbolic forest and a symbolic desert and a vast plateau of oval shapes, wavy and dune-like, a chimerical country like Atlantis or Ultima Thule. They will follow signs, a rainbow-colored beehouse, an ancient sundial, egg-shaped pebbles in an army helmet, a peregrine falcon, to a sacred cave, a stalactite grotto, a non-stillness guarded by a salamander. Here their guide will desert them as the author abandons his book, saying, "My longing is dead. I know it. I know its place in my heart. It's there but dead. So where can I go now? And where am I? Do places exist no longer? Have I burned up all the light inside me? Can't I look forward to beauty any longer? Am I then lost? Is it all up with me? Or am I, in my weakness, at my goal?" Who is this guide? Like Hanke, he's a writer, promising images in space, in the shaping of a story. But he's also an illusionist. The soldier complains, "He didn't guide me straight into the distance, but led me around in a circle with his magic signs, deeper and deeper into a labyrinth." Ought these abandoned pilgrims look for their lost guide anyway, in the ruins of Europa? Well, yes, they tell themselves, "We remembered how in childhood we had often hidden from others because we wanted them to look for us." And where are they? It was possible, we are told, to imagine this was a region offering escape from history, yet at the same time a new country where something might be begun. And yes, we seem to have gone backward in time, through geologic ages to the prehistoric childhood of the race, a geography of the present tense, where, quote, "the infant Moses in his basket will float forever in the slowly flowing Nile." We may have gone as well on a standard mystic quest, like Sufi Lapwings and Hermann Hesse, toward annihilation of the self. We appear to have left the corrupt city and the loveless culture for raptures of the oceanic. Through dreams and art and madness and pine cones, we apparently arrive at the now with a hatful of mushrooms. From modern science to deep ecology, from superego back to id. Like Thomas Mann, we die in Venice. I'm automatically suspicious of any German language parable that loves nature and hates culture, but at least the language in this one dazzles. As for the meaning, your guess is as good as mine.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine. He's also a columnist for New York Newsday and media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Absence by Peter Handke. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person, with assistance from Joan Tuohy and Roberta Shurrock. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The African National Congress is participating in unprecedented talks with the white South African government. On the next Fresh Air, some background and analysis from Alistair Sparks, the former editor of the liberal South African paper The Rand Daily Mail. He's currently a South African correspondent for The Washington Post. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
And weekday mornings between 5 and 6, only here on WHYY-FM, Philadelphia.
It's 8 o'clock on 91FM, WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. My name is Melinda Whiting, and Dan Lachlan is our engineer for Evening Classics tonight up until 11 o'clock. In this...